Whoa! Where'd you manage to find these? Shirley asked, staring in wide-eyed awe at the three giant paintings stacked in the trunk of my car.
Flea market, I said proudly, dusting off my hands after touching the edge of the old copper frame. Real bargain, too.
I thought they would look great on the far side of the cafe, right by the tall stools.
What do you think? I turned to my manager, who had tasked me with finding some extra decorations for the new Starbucks branch she was opening. I had been scouring online marketplaces and websites for something to fill the back wall of the cafe, and had finally come across these when I had visited a local flea market over the weekend.
I trust you, Shirley finally said, patting my shoulder gently. And these do match really well with the existing furniture. Well done, Tish.
I beamed at her praise, glad I hadn't messed up such an important task. The new branch had its grand opening the day after tomorrow, and everything needed to be in place before then.
Great. I'll start putting these up today. You don't happen to have a drill lying around, do you?
I scratched the back of my neck with a sheepish smile.
I forgot to bring my tools.
Shirley chuckled. Ask Mary. I'm sure he'll have something you can use. With a nod, she wandered off, and I began carefully unloading the paintings from the back of the car, making sure I didn't crack the frames with my heavy-handedness. I carried them one at a time from my car into the cafe, laying them out on the table in the break room so that I could give them a once-over. The style could only be described as abstract. There were no legible figures in the paintings, just swirls of colors and patterns that matched the chic modern aesthetic of the coffee shop. The colors were muted instead of garish, with specks of gold that complemented the gold accents of the furniture. As soon as I saw them, I knew they'd be perfect. Mary managed to source a drill for me, as well as gloves and safety goggles, so I got to work measuring and installing the hooks for the paintings to hang from. After half an hour of drilling, and measuring, and drilling again, the hooks were finally in place, and the floor was covered in plaster and dust. Shirley shot me a raised brow at the mess, but I promised her I would vacuum up every last particle, which seemed to appease her. With the hooks done, I unplugged the drill, took off my goggles, and inspected my handiwork. They seemed evenly spaced and straight, but the real test would be mounting the paintings themselves. Mary had been polishing them for the past 20 minutes, and now the copper frames gleamed blood red beneath the fluorescence. He helped me put them up, and after cleaning up the mess on the floor, I finally dusted off my hands and grinned.
"They look great," Shirley said from behind us.
Mary was quiet, staring hard at the painting on the right, a multitudinous swirl of pinks and grays. "Something wrong?" I asked him. He seemed to snap out of his daze, flashing me a hurried smile.
No, it's just... Is it me, or is there a face in that painting?
I frowned at him, then at the artwork, trying to pinpoint where he was looking. "I don't see a face," I told him. "All I see is swirly things." Mary pursed his lips, pointing to a section of the painting in the corner.
"There, see? There's eyes, and a nose, and a chin."
He followed the curve of the line with his fingers, but I was still struggling to see the face he was talking about. "Maybe," I said nonchalantly. "I've never been one of those people who see faces and images and things, though. Take me cloud watching, and all I see are clouds." Mary nodded.
"I'm probably just seeing things," he said, clearing his throat.
"But yeah, I think they look great." He shot the painting a final, questioning look before walking away, humming to himself. I shrugged it off. As long as the customers didn't complain, it didn't matter what we thought. At least now we didn't have to stare at a blank wall. The opening of the new Starbucks branch ended up being a success. I was exhausted by the time I was ready to clock out of my shift, having been rushed off my feet serving the steady flow of customers coming into the cafe. As I was heading to the staff room to grab my stuff, I was apprehended by a young woman.
"Hello, do you work here?"
the woman asked, holding hands with a young girl who had tears streaming down her cheeks. Is everything okay? I asked, my gaze flicking across to the girl's teary-eyed look and back to the woman. The woman's lips pursed, and she turned to point at something behind her.
I'm not sure that's very appropriate to have in a family-friendly cafe like this, she said. My daughter was very upset when she saw it.
I stared at her in confusion.
I'm sorry, I don't understand, I said,
following the direction of her outstretched hand. She was pointing towards the paintings.
What do you mean, not appropriate? Having scary faces on the walls, the woman clarified. In the paintings, there are some horrible faces. Like I said, it made my daughter very upset.
I gave her another bewildered look.
There are no faces in those paintings, ma'am. It's just abstract art.
The woman gave me a disapproving glare.
I'd appreciate it if you didn't dismiss my concerns. Can I take the matter to your manager?
I hurriedly shook my head.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to dismiss them. I just don't see any faces, I admitted, scratching my cheek. But I'll take a look and I'll discuss the matter with my senior. I'm very sorry for the trouble it caused you and your daughter.
The woman gave me another narrow look before hurrying out of the cafe, her daughter sniffling behind her.
What the hell was that all about? What scary faces was she talking about?
I wandered casually up to the paintings and had a closer look, but I couldn't see anything that would frighten someone to tears. With a sigh, I decided to mention it to Shirley when she was in the following morning, and got my stuff ready to leave. Several more complaints cropped up in the days following the shop's opening. All of them related in some way to the gruesome and horrible faces that people were seeing in the paintings I had bought. No matter how hard I looked, I couldn't see anything that resembled a human face amongst the swaths of color, and couldn't comprehend why people were getting so upset by it. I thought maybe it had been a prank at first, set up by Mary or another colleague. But people's reactions were far too genuine for it to just be made up. I ended up bringing the matter to Shirley, who asked me to find something different to put up instead. Although she couldn't see anything wrong with them either, the amount of complaints we were receiving was ruining our reputation, and it was best to just switch out the decor to avoid repercussions in the future. In the end, I managed to find some simple, block-colored paintings that still matched the cafe, and stayed behind late one afternoon to put them up. I didn't like them quite as much as the abstract ones, but hopefully it would be enough to stop people complaining. I carried the old paintings into the break room, setting them down on the table. I was the only one there, since everyone else had gone home, and most of the lights were off, casting eerie shadows around the cafe. As I was getting ready to leave and close up, something caught my attention. What looked like eyes staring back at me from the painting. My heart jerked in my chest as I stared at the picture on the table. It had changed. The pink had turned into a sickly, flesh-colored hue, and the gray had darkened, forming dark shadows along the canvas. And in the middle of it all was a face, with dark gouges for eyes, and its mouth open in an endless scream, the swirls of pink coming together in a pale, fleshy mirage. The image made me feel sick to my stomach. That face, where had it come from? Is this what everyone had been seeing? Feeling a chill creep over my spine, I grabbed the three paintings, trying not to look too hard at them, and tossed them into the trash bins behind the cafe. Then I closed up the shop and tried to erase the memory of the gruesome face in the painting completely from my mind. It was a typical Thursday evening. I was lounging on my worn-out couch, lazily scrolling through social media and texting friends. The apartment was quiet, the only sounds being the faint hum of the refrigerator and the occasional creak of the wooden floors. It was getting late, and my eyelids were growing heavy. I decided it was time to call it a night. I got up, stretched, and made my way to the bathroom. The familiar routine of brushing my teeth and washing my face always had a soothing effect. After that, I headed to my bedroom, changed into my comfy pajamas, and slipped under the covers. As I settled in, I reached out for my phone to set the alarm, only to realize it wasn't there. Panic instantly set in. I tossed the blankets aside and checked the nightstand, but my phone was nowhere to be found. Where did I leave it? I muttered to myself, trying to retrace my steps. I distinctly remembered having it in the living room, so I got out of bed and headed there. The living room looked just as I had left it. I checked the couch cushions, the coffee table, and even the floor, but my phone was missing. Growing more frustrated, I moved to the bathroom. Maybe I had absentmindedly left it there while washing up. But after a thorough search, it became clear that the phone was not in the bathroom either. By this point, a sense of dread was creeping in. It didn't make any sense. I searched every nook and cranny of my small apartment, turning it upside down. After an hour of fruitless searching, I was exhausted and more than a little freaked out. I decided to use my computer to call my phone, hoping the ringtone would lead me to it. I logged into my Gmail account and dialed my number. The sound of my ringtone broke the silence, but it wasn't coming from anywhere I had searched. It was faint and muffled. I followed the sound, my heart pounding in my chest. It was coming from my bedroom closet. With trembling hands, I opened the closet door. The sound was louder now, but it was still muffled. I rummaged through my clothes and shoes, following the ringtone. Then, to my utter bewilderment, I found my phone wrapped up in a plastic grocery bag buried under a pile of shoes. I stared at it in disbelief. How in the world did it get there? I hadn't touched that pile of shoes in weeks, and I certainly hadn't put my phone in a plastic bag. I unwrapped it and held it, the screen lighting up with my missed call notification. "Hello?" I answered, half expecting to hear something sinister on the other end, but there was only silence. I hung up and sat down on the floor, trying to make sense of what had just happened. Nothing about that night added up. I knew I hadn't put my phone in the closet, let alone wrapped it in a plastic bag. It felt as if someone or something had been playing a twisted game with me. The thought of an intruder crossed my mind, but there were no signs of forced entry, and nothing else was out of place. To this day, I have no explanation for how my phone ended up in that closet. It remains one of the most unsettling experiences of my life. I've moved to a new place since then, but every now and then, when I'm alone at night, I can't help but feel a shiver run down my spine, wondering if whatever was in that apartment has followed me. I felt my heartbeat thrumming in my ears as I looked at the red and blue lights flashing through the lobby windows. Sweat dripped down my back, mixing with the cold shivers that racked my body. I leaned against the bathroom sink, staring at my reflection. My face was ashen, my eyes wide with a mix of fear and confusion. I had just finished throwing up, my body convulsing with every retch. It was like my body knew something terrible was about to happen. I took a deep breath, wiping my mouth with the back of my hand. I needed to get home. I needed the safety of my apartment, the comfort of my mother. I pushed open the bathroom door, stepping into the lobby. The lights were brighter now, the sirens louder. I squinted, trying to make sense of the chaos outside. And then, a rough hand grabbed my arm, yanking me backward. "Get on the ground!" a voice shouted. I barely had time to react before I was shoved to the floor, my cheek pressing against the cold tiles. My arms were wrenched behind my back, handcuffs biting into my wrists. Panic surged through me, my stomach churning again. I couldn't breathe, couldn't think. What was happening? "Please!" I gasped. I live here! I didn't do anything!"
The officer's grip loosened slightly, but he didn't let go.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
I swallowed hard, trying to find my voice.
"I'm Clara. I live here with my mom. I just got home."
My voice trembled, tears stinging my eyes.
"Did you let anyone in?"
he asked. I shook my head, my mind racing.
"No, I didn't. I was in the bathroom. I felt sick."
He studied my face for a moment, then nodded.
"All right. We're going to check this out. Come with me."
I followed him, my legs shaky. The lobby was filled with police officers and detectives, their faces grim. I noticed the apartment door next to ours was wide open, more officers inside. The air was thick with tension and the metallic scent of blood. My stomach turned again, but I forced myself to stay calm.
"What's going on?"
I whispered. The officer glanced at me. "A woman was attacked in her apartment. Her boyfriend. Brutal assault. He got away, but we're looking for him." My blood ran cold. I remembered the elevator, the sick feeling that had driven me to the bathroom. If I hadn't been sick, I might have been in that elevator with him. I might have been his next victim. They let me go once they verified my story, but the fear didn't leave me. I couldn't shake the image of the beaten woman. Couldn't stop wondering what might have happened if our paths had crossed. Every time I stepped into the lobby, I felt a wave of nausea, my mind replaying that night over and over again. I couldn't escape it. My mother tried to comfort me, but I could see the worry in her eyes.
"You need to talk to someone, Clara," she said gently one evening. "You can't keep this bottled up inside."
I nodded, but I couldn't bring myself to open up. The fear was too raw, too real. I started carrying a small knife with me, the weight of it in my pocket a small comfort. I practiced using it, imagining the attacker's face, channeling my anger into each thrust and slash. It was the only thing that made me feel safe, even if just a little. One night, as I was lying in bed, my phone buzzed with a message. It was from a number I didn't recognize. My heart skipped a beat as I read the words. "You were lucky that night." I sat up, my hands shaking.
Who was this? How did they know?
My mind raced, a thousand thoughts colliding. I texted back, my fingers trembling, "Who is this?" The response was immediate. "You should be more careful. Not everyone is as lucky as you." Panic surged through me. I called the police, but they couldn't trace the number. It was a burner phone, they said. I felt trapped, like a rabbit in a snare, my fear wrapping tighter around me with each passing day. I started to notice things. A shadow lingering in the hallway, the feeling of being watched. My paranoia grew, feeding my anxiety. I couldn't trust anyone, couldn't let my guard down. Every stranger was a potential threat, every sound in the night a harbinger of danger. Then, one evening, as I was walking home, I saw him, the boyfriend. He was standing across the street, watching me. Our eyes met, and a cruel smile twisted his lips. I froze, my heart pounding in my chest. He started walking towards me, and I bolted, running as fast as I could. I didn't stop until I was inside my apartment, the door locked and bolted behind me. I called the police again, but they couldn't find him. I felt like I was losing my mind, the fear consuming me. I didn't sleep that night. My knife clutched tightly in my hand. I couldn't let him get to me.
I wouldn't let him.
Days passed without incident, but the tension never left. Every time I stepped outside, I felt his eyes on me. Every night, I dreamed of his hands around my throat, squeezing the life out of me. I was living in a nightmare, and there was no escape. One evening, as I was coming home, I saw the figure in the shadows. My heart raced, but this time, I was ready. I pulled out my knife, the blade glinting in the dim light. The figure stepped forward, and I lunged, my fear turning to rage. But as the blade connected, I realized my mistake. It wasn't him. It was one of the officers who had come to check on me. He fell to the ground, clutching his side, blood seeping through his fingers. I dropped the knife, my hands shaking.
"Oh my God," I whispered. I'm so sorry. I thought you were him."
The officer's face was pale, his eyes filled with pain.
"It's okay,"
he gasped.
"Just get help."
They took me in, but I wasn't charged. It was self-defense, they said. America has been good to me. It's been half a decade since Ayan and I have moved here due to the fighting back in our home country of Somalia. I would not pretend that I had moved to America for the dream or the prospect of living the big life, as I would learn was possible in the new country. Our move had been strictly one of desperation, to escape that dreary life of mind-numbing violence which was partly fueled by well-motivated militia and killers with nothing but the intoxicating smell of blood. In many regards, America was different from Somalia. In America, I could work. It was not as easy in Somalia, regardless of the fact that I had decent education before the war had broken out. The new country offered Ayan and me some fighting chance to live as people ought to, and not as it was back in Somalia. In the small time since I had moved here, I had secured jobs that fine-tuned my skill to the level of being a manager at the local Starbucks. My job was great. And even though most of the customers I dealt with had an attitude unlike anything I had faced back home, it was by far better. It made Ayan and I happy that we could live decently and even seek out a community of fellow Somali that had migrated with us to America, some of whom we had known from back home. Abdi was one such man. Abdi knew me before I knew him. An acquaintance of ours had told him about me before he moved with his family. He was a firm believer of the faith, as I was, so it was easy for us to bond over our shared belief. America had some strange culture that we did not agree with, but with Abdi, it was obvious that he was not pleased with it, even though he did well to follow my advice of masking his displeasure. "Sin is sin wherever it was committed, and it falls to the righteous to correct the way of the unjust," Abdi would say to me. "Woe be on us, brother, if we fall astray of the path of the teachings." I agreed with him that we must be firm in our faith and not fall astray. By all considerations of conversations and demeanor, nothing betrayed Abdi's announcement at me until that evening when he suddenly appeared at the Starbucks raging like one drunk on a portion of pee which I had served him. His appearance set him off before he arrived where I was. "Abdul! You weak-livered unbeliever!" He rolled the words off his tongue as though my name were a curse on his lips, which he could not bear to hold for too long lest he offend his beliefs. "You are no man!" He spoke in a mixture of our native language and Arabic, the dearest languages of his thoughts and expression of emotions. It was no joking matter. I was glad I was on my feet just behind the till because I was a man short for the night. Abdi was trembling as he spoke, his anger causing his body to quiver like a leaf on a breezy evening.
"Abdi, brother, what trouble have you brought to me in my place of work?" I replied to him in our private language of conversation so the customers would have no idea what his grouse was or my offense had been.
I curse you! You are no brother of mine! I will kill you right this minute where you stand!
Abdi's voice rose and rose.
I will wipe the curse of your family from this earth! How have you strayed from the faith?
I tried to reconcile his perch to an offense I may have been guilty of, and nothing came to me immediately. My face betrayed my concern and panic at his behavior. Abdi continued, and before I could confront my shock, the security quickly came to take him away. I shrugged and tried to continue my work, but an uneasy feeling lingered, even as I knew that Abdi had been removed from my presence. His words made its round in my ears and my senses. It terrified me greatly, and even though I tried to maintain some level of composure, it was obvious that it was shallow. And then it struck me.
Please, no!
I blurted in horror, flicking my wristwatch over. I had 50 minutes left until it was time to clock out, but I couldn't wait. My bowels loosened and my muscles contracted so stiffly that walking was a chore for me. I called one of the guys and told him to cover for me, as I had some place that I needed to be as a matter of urgency. Whether he gave his consent to it or not, I would not know. I rushed out of that Starbucks and ran with all of the strength I had to my house. Tears streamed down my face, kissing the wind as I ran. My heart almost exploded in my chest from fear of what Abdi would do. I knew the man. I knew what drove him. I slipped my phone out of my pocket and immediately called 911 to report that I may be needing police help as a crime was happening, as I hoped it would not have happened, at my house. They asked if I was sure, and I turned my phone off, hoping to the heavens that Abdi did not get to Ayan before me. When I arrived home and shoved my door open, my worst fears materialized in front of me. I almost collapsed to the floor from the weight of dejection which I felt in that moment as I saw Ayan on her knees, with Abdi standing to her side with the sharpest knife I had ever seen in my life in his grip.
You are a disgrace to the faith, Abdul. Your wife cheated and you stick with her?
Abdi spat out a frothy spittle at me. The blob landed on my shoe.
I will do what you cannot, and I will regain your honor.
Please, Abdul, I don't want to die,
Ayan begged.
Do not, Abdi, brother, I beg you,
I pleaded, beside myself with fear that made sweat slink down the spinal column of my back.
I should kill you too when I'm done with her,
Abdi promised. And without uttering another word, he proceeded to place the blade on her neck. My heart jumped into the hollow space of my mouth and my eyes turned red from sheer dread. My knees could not support the weight of my body. It was a nightmare. It was my nightmare. I almost tumbled over where I stood. My world was crashing before my eyes. And Abdi, maddened with rage, had seen the face of God sanctioning this terror. I gave up, until the door behind me yanked open with a forceful bang.
Drop your weapon!
The cops hollered as they burst into the room. Two shots rang out, and the room was suddenly in chaos. Ayan crawled to me, and the cops guided us outside as the terror of our lives was brought to an end.
My name is Wilson, and I'm 44 years old. I'm a medical doctor, and I live with my wife, Cassandra, and our only daughter, Meryl. My wife runs her small business in which she buys and sells antiques. As for Meryl, she is now 26 years old and still lives with us. Our daughter, Meryl, decided to follow in my steps. She managed to get into university and study medicine. Hopefully in the future, we can open our own clinic, Dad. The two of us working together. What do you think? Meryl said, excited. That's a wonderful idea. But you just started, and there's a lot of years of study ahead of you. It's tough. I just want you to be prepared for hard work, Meryl. Yeah, I know. And I look forward to it. But dreaming and making plans for the future is a good incentive, I think, my daughter replied. revealing her natural optimism, something that I always loved about her. During the first 6 months after her classes started, Meryl was indeed very enthusiastic, and she was studying hard. It was obvious that she enjoyed the medical course because she would speak a lot about what she was learning. It wasn't just to impress me or her mother. However, after that period, she stopped talking to us as she used to. And not just about medicine, but about life in general. She wasn't asking us, her parents, any questions or made jokes as it was common for her. Meryl was a happy and extroverted person, but her behavior changed. We noticed that she was now spending a lot of time with her cell phone. You sure have been spending a lot of time on that thing, chatting with your friends from med school or any teacher? My wife asked our daughter. Huh? I'm using Snapchat, Mom. Yeah, I also chat with my friends, but there's so much more to learn. I met very interesting people thanks to this app. Don't worry, it's nothing like flirting or anything. I guess you can call them conspiracy theories. But the evidence is everywhere. People are kept in the dark, but I'm not. Not anymore, Meryl answered. Well, as long as you don't leave your studies and your real friends behind, and mostly don't go meeting anyone from the internet, I said. During the family conversation, which Meryl barely removed her eyes from her cell phone. Yeah, of course. You can trust me, Meryl replied. At first, I wasn't worried about it. My daughter was young. It was perfectly natural for her to be interested in such things. It was all part of growing up, and it was also a good thing for her not to become overly obsessed with medicine. I thought that after a few weeks, she would just find a perfect balance between university and her newfound Snapchat X-Files friends. Unfortunately, balance wasn't exactly the word to describe what Meryl was about to go through. One day, I got a phone call. It was one of Meryl's friends from university, a girl named Kate. Apparently, my daughter had a panic attack and had to be taken to the hospital. Thank you for calling me, Kate. I'm on my way, I said. The girl was already there at the hospital, waiting for the doctors to say how my daughter was doing. I drove there as fast as I could, canceling all my appointments at the clinic. I decided not to tell anything to my wife, at least for a few hours, until I, myself, could get some answers. Hello, Kate. Oh, God, thank you again for being here. The doctors just told me that Meryl is now asleep after her panic attack. They said she had to be sedated. She's fine, for now, but some tests and exams need to be done. Can you tell me what happened? Meryl was completely taken over by some dude she chats with on Snapchat. She said that they trusted her and wanted to share some classified government secrets with her about aliens. Oh, no. Yeah, I know, it's odd, but this afternoon, after receiving some texts and pictures, Meryl just snapped and started screaming. They're here among us, an alien race. They want to replace us human beings by alien clones who look like each one of us. It's happening for decades, if not longer. Here, see for yourself. They abduct us, take us away, and experiment on us before killing us for food and energy. While the clones take our place on Earth, and the government knows about it, they're selling us to the aliens in exchange for technology and cooperation. And then, immediately after, her panic attack took place. Meryl couldn't breathe, and her body just shut down. Fortunately, the emergencies were fast enough and took her to the hospital in due time. Thank you for the explanation, Kate. Obviously, my daughter needs therapy. In any case, did somebody actually see the weird pictures that she received? I asked. I'm her closest friend in university, so I was the one who brought her the things, including her cell phone. I did check her Snapchat, but I didn't see anything weird. No texts or pictures or anything. In any case, here it is. Her cell phone and her wallet. You can look for yourself, Kate said, handing my daughter's belongings to me. Just like Kate said, there was nothing bizarre. At least that I was able to see on Meryl's Snapchat. A couple days later, Meryl was allowed to return home. There was nothing wrong with her, physically, at least. She was taking some antipsychotic medicines. Plus, I convinced her that she had to see a psychiatrist as well. He's a good friend of mine. You just go there to talk, and if you don't like it after the first couple visits, you can leave, I said. Okay, Dad, but it's true. All those things, she insisted, but she was at least calming down, I think. I didn't see anything on your cell phone, Meryl. Even so, you could easily be fooled, like many people. Nothing to be ashamed of, I replied. But they're coming for me. The aliens. I heard them. They communicate through thoughts. I was warned, Meryl said. No one is coming for you, dear, I answered, hugging my daughter, feeling genuinely concerned about her mental health. A couple weeks later, I heard my daughter screaming in her bedroom during the middle of the night. Both me and my wife ran towards Meryl's bedroom. The door was locked, and the screaming stopped out of the blue. Meryl! Meryl, what happened? We heard you screaming. I'm going to break the lock, I shouted. After a few seconds, Meryl simply opened the door, sounding and seeming very calm, almost bored. Mom? Dad? What's wrong? I was sleeping, and you woke me up, she said with inquisitive and cold eyes. You were screaming. Why is your window open? I guess I forgot to lock it. As for the screams, I was probably dreaming. Can I go back to sleep? Yeah. Of course. Sleep tight, I said as we returned to our rooms. From that night on, Meryl never spoke about aliens again. In fact, she barely speaks. And even when she does, I can sense that something is different about her. Even when she smiles, it seems bland, rehearsed, fake. But on the brighter side, she's back to being a great student. And she's going to graduate soon enough with top grades. Oddly enough, she never spoke about her idea of becoming my partner ever again. To be honest with you, Meryl seems like a different person altogether. And I can't stop thinking about her words about alien replacements who take real people away. Could it be true? Did they take my daughter away